Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Nikki Sweat, your host. On the Music at Menlo concert on Thursday, the 20th of July, we'll go from Bach to Beethoven with great pieces of chamber music from the classical era. We won't hear from J.S. Bach, but rather from his son, Johann Christian, or as he came to be known when he moved to London, John Bach. Music of Mozart, one of J.C. Bach's most successful students, and of Haydn will give us a taste for the formal clarity and energy of classical era music, warming up our ears for the innovative turn-of-the-century septet of Ludwig van Beethoven. J.C. Bach broke from the family track of pursuing a stable musical career as a church or court Kapellmeister when he moved to London, where he started a very successful concert series with his friend Carl Friedrich Abel. He would write new works for the performances, and many of the small ensemble pieces he composed in the 1760s and 1770s were likely workshopped and premiered on this series, so it's probable that his Opus 11 quintets, for the interesting combination of flute, oboe, violin, viola, and continuo, were written in the early 1770s for a group of colleagues whom he would get together for these concerts. I spoke with the oboist James Austin Smith, who told me more about what Bach might have been doing with this instrumentation.
It does kind of call back to the Baroque form of the trio sonata, where you would have two treble instruments and then a basso continuo of some kind, whether that be bassoon and harpsichord or cello and harpsichord. Here we just see maybe an elaboration on that. I also noticed that there are some editions where you do have that Baroque tradition where it's okay to play it, say, with three violins instead of flute, oboe, and violin. I don't know if that's something J.C. Bach himself said was fine, but I imagine that was just in the water. But it makes for a nice combination of treble instruments, and you get, if there were three violins, it's almost like too much treble. With the different tone colors, maybe it softens things a little bit. The thing that stuck out to me the most was the virtuosic writing of the flute in the flute part. That I thought, wow, I'm glad I'm not trying to play that on the oboe. You have a really nice democratic way of dividing these upper lines. There is one spot in the first movement, which I was quite taken by, where it actually starts as an ascending line on the viola and then to the violin and then to the oboe and then to the flute. And I thought that was really quite cool because even the viola gets a moment to do something interesting. In fact, the viola gets a few moments to do interesting things. So you almost have a situation where there's three treble instruments plus viola, which is quite cool. The second movement is fun. It's sort of as it is. It's fun. And it's interesting to think, I know we're going to talk about the Haydn divertimento, of course. If there were two or three more movements to this piece, it could be called a divertimento too. It says something lovely and then it moves on, or in this case, it's over.
In the 1760s, Joseph Haydn's career completely changed. He was awarded a position as Kapellmeister for the powerful Esterházy family. It was a job that gave him stability for the rest of his life, but for which he was required to produce an unbelievable amount of music for concerts, for hunts, for various social occasions. And we must imagine that it was for some such occasion that he wrote his divertimento in C major for winds and strings, HOB 211. Many of Haydn's works have subtitles, which may or may not have been assigned by the composer himself, but which give the listener scenes to imagine something that's going on with the music that we hear. This piece actually has two subtitles. The whole divertimento is called the Birthday Divertimento, and the second movement was specifically given the interesting title of Husband and Wife. James gave me some background on classical divertimentos and his take on how these titles relate to what we actually hear in Haydn's music.
You see the word divertimento, or you see it in French divertissement, you know immediately that it's for fun, that it comes from this idea that this is music to be enjoyed, to be pleasing. It's light and it's lively, lots of wonderful character shifts. I always enjoy playing divertimenti, and we have a lot of them as wind players, because maybe we put it that this was music that might have accompanied something else. So it might have been a meal, or it might have been a party, and we have lots of wind divertimenti because oftentimes those events were outdoors. And so you have the slightly louder, more projecting voices of the winds that maybe you could hear it a little more over the din of the chatter. It's always good for a piece to have a name other than divertimento in C major. So we'll accept birthday. The easy thing to say would be it's a very joyful piece, which it is. We can go back to the whole idea of a divertimento. It's, you know, it's a party. It's for fun. In the second movement, you have the high strings. The first fiddle really quite high. Sort of shadowed by the second fiddle an octave down. And then you have the double bass, super, super low. Doesn't happen a lot in music that we have that pairing of super high and super low. It's sweet in this situation, and it's got a name, and it's got a sort of maybe a little bit of a story that we also don't know, but, you know, we can call it Man and Wife. We know Haydn had a great sense of humor, so I have to imagine that that's at play here. I don't think he was being incredibly serious in this moment.
In the Baroque and classical eras, it was pretty common for composers to write obbligato, or obligatory, at the top of particular instrumental parts. In this divertimento, for example, Haydn writes obbligato for the flute, the oboe, and also the cello. I asked James what this term means in general, and also what the indication says about instrumental roles in this particular piece.
In the Baroque, you see basso obbligato. And what I understood from a bit of reading that I did is that in the Baroque era implied that it was literally, you were obligated. You were obligated to use these instruments. And if we think about concerts and performances in much more loose terms than we think about them now, to go back to what I was saying in J.C. Bach about how treble voices might have been interchangeable, you can see why the composer might feel a need to tell the performer, hey, you have to do what I'm writing here. This is not optional, because a lot of the rest of it might have been quite optional. That doesn't make any sense in this instance, because you can't just say we don't want the flute today, because you'd be missing 1/5 of the piece, right? Then I wondered, okay, is it, when we think of oboe obbligato, we think about something that's prominent. Maybe it's an aria with oboe and soprano and continuo, and then it's the obbligato that's on top of the soprano aria. Again, necessary, but also implying a certain amount of importance. You're a major part of this ensemble rather than just a sort of accompanimental figure. But that also doesn't make a lot of sense because he marks flute, oboe, and cello as obbligato in the score. This rabbit hole became deeper and deeper, okay? And I came to an academic paper, and there was in a footnote that suggested that it may be the case that obbligato was written next to instruments that might not think they were important in the context of the score, but the composer wanted them to know that they were. Which would explain why the violin is not marked obbligato, violin one, but the other three instruments are. This is centuries of musician jokes. The violinist, the first violinist, does not need to be told that they are important. They will assume that that's the case. But the flutist or the oboist, or especially the cellist in this era where the cello would have been far more of a kind of bass instrument rather than, say, a soloistic melodic instrument, we are important too. In fact, we might even be as important as the violin. And that bears out, actually, in the writing, especially in the cello in this piece, because the cello has quite a lot to do, which is a little bit surprising, again, given this form. The first time you really notice the sort of prominence of the cello is in the minuet and trio, specifically the trio, where all of a sudden there's a cello solo. As an oboe player, if you think about Haydn symphonies, for example, we live for those minuets and trios, because often in the trios, there's a number of Haydn symphonies where the oboe gets to shine and really shine. And you get to do everything twice, because in a trio, you repeat both sections. And so to see it here and see it in the cello is very surprising in this case. And then, as if that weren't enough, Haydn gives the cellist a variation in the theme and variations in the last movement, also a bit soloistic. Also get a variation in the theme of variations, the fourth variation. Maybe this is the diva oboe player in me, but I saw obbligato, I started thinking about it and came to this potential understanding of it, and then thought, well, he could have been a little more generous in this piece. I would say maybe there is a sort of democratic distribution of wealth here. And as the oboe player, I'll accept it.
Shifting instrumental roles are important to understanding what W.A. Mozart does in his late works for piano, violin, and cello, including the 1788 trio in G major, K564. At this time, the piano trio was not a fixed instrumentation. The stable trio who would tour together performing a body of music intended for these forces, which is a common occurrence today, didn't really exist yet. So works for these instruments tended to be composed as piano sonatas, intended for amateur keyboardists to play at home, with violin and cello parts added to give the work some filled-out, concerto-like properties. In the pieces he wrote in the late 1780s, Mozart began to push against that trend, in particular by giving the cello a little bit more to do, and by using the piano trio as a forum for exploring some interesting formal turns. In the first movement of the trio in G major, for example, the piano is clearly the center of attention in the primary theme. But the secondary theme gives a lot of space to the violin, and subtly also to the cello, who has this accompaniment gesture with highly expressive markings, suggesting a bit like Haydn's obbligato indication, "Hey, cellist, you're extremely important too." Piano is, of course, not neglected at all. Much of the movement is taken up with soloistic transitions or virtuosic figuration. But Mozart rhetorically confirms the great importance and independence of the cello line in the recapitulation, where the low string player introduces the secondary theme tune, and the violin plays that expressive accompanimental tenuto-filled part, while the keyboard is resigned to a light pa-pa-pa bass line. In the second movement, a theme and variation set, the piano's part goes on a gradual journey from stating the simple theme in plain eighth notes to commenting on it with slow 16th notes. And also some wandering triplets. But the true action of the movement is in the string parts, which offer more and more densely conceived renditions of the tune and explore some quite gnarly and provocative harmonies. The finale is perhaps the most piano sonata-like of the three movements. The keyboard alone introduces the playful refrain, which features the dancing Baroque Sicilian rhythm. In contrasting episodes, the violin at least gets to stand out a little bit more, in the first taking us through a fantastic simple modulating sequence, and in the second episode, piano and violin both take turns on a swashbuckling Viennese dancing figure. When the piano plays it, it's quite clean, and when the violin plays it, it gives it this warmth and grittiness that's extremely effective. ¶¶ This movement might be heard as a last hurrah for the piano sonata or violin sonata approach to trio writing. With his Opus 1 piano trios, Ludwig van Beethoven would completely change how composers came to this set of instruments. And in other chamber music he wrote, he made sure that each and every player's role was extremely soloistic. So let's enjoy the primacy or centrality of the keyboard in this piece while we've got it. Ludwig van Beethoven had an odd sense of humor. It's on display in this note that he sent in late 1800 to Anton Hofmeister, his friend and a music publisher. The letter was about a curious recent composition. As Beethoven put it, a septet for violin, viola, violoncello, bass, clarinet, horn, bassoon. Tutti obbligati. And then in parentheses, I cannot write anything non-obbligato, for I came into this world with an obbligato accompaniment. He could not have more perfectly summed up the shift in assumptions about the importance of playing the assigned part that took place at the end of the 18th century, and his own hand in cementing this change at the start of the 1800s. There was to be no more casual part swapping. Every line from the grumblings of the double bass to the supportive arpeggios of the horn to the fluttering filigree of the violin is intimately, essentially tied to the particular timbre of the intended instrument. It's a philosophy that would largely remain in place until strictures around concert music broke down at the start of the 20th century. Still, for a piece of seven obbligato parts, Beethoven's septet does seem to give the violin a pretty outsized role. I spoke about these tensions and about the joys and challenges of this work with the cellist Mihai Merica.
It feels like a great party piece that's also extremely flashy. So you have seven people interacting in many different ways and many different combinations, which if I imagine you had a group of seven friends back in the day who played these instruments, it would be a lot of fun to put together. But then the violin part is kind of like a concerto, so your violinist friend would have to be a very, very capable player. Even for early Beethoven, the character is so bright. I think overall, you leave that piece with a feeling of, wow, that was mostly fun in terms of affect, right? So I think that would probably contribute to its success and also contributed to why Beethoven later on didn't feel so good about its success. I think he was at a point in his life where he was still very much developing, even though he had established himself. I read that he was particularly proud of the septet at the time of publishing because it had something to do with his relationship with Haydn. He felt at the time that he hadn't written anything quite as potent and as creative as Haydn's work. Inside himself, I think he was trying to prove himself. And apparently he said about his septet when it was first performed that this is, I quote, this is my creation, referring to Haydn's creation, which was super popular at the time, which indicates a almost too much confidence from young Beethoven, you know, but he was very proud of it. After the pretty somber and orchestral introduction, the violin just kind of takes over and doesn't let go for for many bars in that first movement. And even when there's dialogue with the other instruments, for example, the clarinet, the way the clarinet responds to the first theme, for example, is almost like a 2D section where everybody's supporting. There are a few moments, though, where other instruments get a few dialogue lines. One big different moment is that the clarinet and bassoon open the proceedings in the development. So again, it's almost concerto-like because you give the soloist a little bit of a rest.
In the second movement, Beethoven starts to give everybody else a little bit more to do, and also creates some atmospheres that are absolutely stunning.
Feel like he's looking at the world from somewhere that's not in the world. So he sees it from afar, from a distance, as a whole. And that's how he expresses all his feelings about it. About halfway through the movement or so, we have just the horn playing repeated notes. And at this moment, you may expect a sort of return of the opening theme, but everything is in suspense, so you're not really sure what's going to happen. And this repeated note, kind of each repetition of it heightens that dot on the question mark. And then we do get the first melody, but instead of being in home key, it's in C major. As an aside, I get to contribute as a cellist to that, that version of the beginning. The third movement is very much like a street band to my ear. It has this Ländler feel, and you could totally see this happening somewhere in the mountains in my imagination. Some of the lines that the horn plays and the clarinet both would have a beautiful resonance somewhere in a valley surrounded by mountains. It's kind of the same with the fifth movement, except when I say street band, now I mean street band. It's the action comes back to the heightened energy of the rhythms. For the trio, we take a little bit of a more of a walking pace. Us cellists get the whole thing, so it's another moment of pride. The first variation in the fourth movement, when the viola starts that variation, you have an elevated amount of love for that theme, but also pride. It's kind of a combination of both. At least that's how I like to hear it. And I think that comes from Beethoven's confidence in his craft. In the fourth variation, there's a kind of preview of later Beethoven. The way he displaces the downbeats in that kind of reminds me of the Ninth Symphony Scherzo in a much lighter version. There are moments in this piece where I feel like Beethoven is being deliberately exaggerated in a way, kind of obvious but also mischievous. So in the coda, you get this wave of the hand and you can almost hear Beethoven saying Auf Wiedersehen. And then the whole thing kind of turns nefarious. Before he slams the door shut. In the sixth movement, it is strange that he goes to this very kind of dark atmosphere. First of all, he probably naturally felt like there's so much brightness in this piece, it needs a little balance. But then the way he goes about it is very dramatic. I think he does it for emphasis. Dark is darker than it needs to be, and then you blow up into this super bright finale. He was aware what a big role the violin played so far. So just like the contrast between the introduction and the brightness of the last movement, I think he just takes that idea and takes it to its extreme. It's also humorous that he writes it out too. You know, you can't make your own cadenza, you're gonna play this cadenza. It's like, have you had enough violin? I don't think you have. Here's a little more.
Audio Notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat, in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to James Austin Smith and Mihai Merica for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. From the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, J.C. Bach's Quintet in G Major for Flute, Oboe, Violin, Viola, and Continuo, Opus 11 No. 2, was performed by Soo-Yun Kim, Flute, Stephen Taylor, Oboe, Meg Freivogel, Violin, Liz Freivogel, Viola, Daniel McDonough, Cello, and Gabriel Schuford on Harpsichord. Haydn's Divertimento in C Major, HOB 211, was played by Paula Robeson, Flute, Leonard Arner, Oboe, James Buswell, Violin, Annie Kavafian, Violin, Leslie Parnas, Cello, Alvin Brem, Double Bass, and Kenneth Cooper, Harpsichord. Mozart's Piano Trio in G Major, K564, was likewise heard on a CMS performance, given by Orion Weiss on piano, Nicholas Dautrecourt on violin, and Mihai Merica on cello. And Beethoven's Septet in E-flat Major, Opus 20, was heard on a Music at Menlo Live album called Beethoven Center of Gravity. The artists were Charles Chandler on double bass, Dennis Godburn, bassoon, Anthony McGill, clarinet, Joseph Silverstein, violin, Ronald Thomas, cello, William Vermeulen, horn, and Geraldine Walter on viola. Audio Notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.